"You're not very chatty," said Care, circling to land at the old defense base, going dead slow because of loose machinery. Johnny came out of it. He pointed at the button camera that hung around his neck.
"Forget it," said Care to his astonishment. "They only have a range of about 2 miles."
He pointed at his work jacket pocket flap. A much smaller button camera with the symbol of the company on it was actually serving as a real button. "Not 5 or more?" asked Johnny.
"Crap, no," said Care. "The security measures of this company are a pain. There's no recorder in this plane. I checked. What the splintered asteroid are we doing hauling this machinery over to this old defense base?"
He looked down.
"It doesn't even look like a defense base anyway."
And it didn't. It was just some buildings, not even a landing field. No bunkers anyone could see. Some kind of a strange series of pointed things standing up at one end.
"Turl gives the orders," said Johnny, a bit resigned.
"Blast, no. These weren't Turl's orders. I saw them. They were signed by the head of the planet. Turl was even complaining. He said he wondered whether old Numph had gone off his computers."
It gave Johnny new data, but not what Care thought. Turl was covering his tracks. This was Turl's project. It made him uneasy.
"This stuff," said Care, with a backward jerk of his head, "is supposed to be practice equipment. But for who? It's perfectly good mining equipment. Hold on, we're going to land."
He pushed the console buttons and the freighter crept down and landed easily and level. Care put on his face mask.
"Another funny thing. There's no supply of breathe gas with any of this stuff. Just what was left in their tanks. You're the only one I know that can operate these machines without breathe gas in the canopies. You're going to operate all these machines?"
He laughed.
"It'd sure run your butt off. Let's unload."
They spent the next hour lining the machines up in an open field near the largest building. There were drillers and flying platforms, cable reelers, ore netters, blade scrapers, and a single transport truck. With the items brought in earlier loads, there were over 30 machines now.
"Let's prowl," said Care. "We've been fast. What's in this big building?"
It consisted only of rooms, rooms, and rooms, each with bunks and lockers. There were what may have been washrooms. Care was prowling for loot, but broken windows and wind and snow had not left much. Dust and indistinguishable debris were thick.
"Already been prowled," was Care's finding. "Let's look elsewhere."
Care clumped through the entrance of another building. Johnny saw that it had been a library, but without Chinko protection, it was mainly litter. 1,000 years of cockroaches had dined on paper. A queer, broken structure that once had had 17 points, Johnny counted them, seemed to have been some kind of a monument. Care entered a door that was no longer there. A cross was still hanging on a wall.
"What's that thing?" said Care.
Johnny knew it was a church cross. He said so.
"Funny thing to have in a defense base," said Care. "You know, I don't think it was a defense base. More like a school."
Johnny looked at Care. The midget cyclo might be thought dim-witted, but he was dead on the mark. Johnny did not tell him there were signs all over the place that said United States Air Force Academy. They wandered back to the freighter.
"I bet we're establishing a school," said Care. "I bet that's what it is we're doing. But who's going to be taught? Not cyclos with no breathe gas, that's for sure. Put up the ramps, Johnny, and we'll get out of here."
Johnny did, but he didn't climb up to the cockpit. He looked around for water and firewood. He had an idea he'd be camping out here. Yes, there was a stream coming down from a nearby snow-capped peak, and there was plenty of firewood in the trees. He walked out and looked at the trench where the last battle had been fought against the cyclos. The grass was tall and waving in a lonesome-sounding wind. He climbed to the freighter cockpit, deeply troubled. 6. At evening, when he opened the cage, Turl sounded excited.
Tell your horses and females goodbye, animal. Tomorrow at dawn we're going on a long trip.
Johnny stopped with his arms full of the firewood he had been taking in.
How long? 5 days, a week, it depends, said Turl. Why do you want to know?
I have to leave them food, a lot of things.
Oh, said Turl indifferently. Am I going to have to stand here and wait?
He made up his own mind. He locked up the cage again and turned on the juice.
I'll come back later.
He rumbled off hurriedly.
Well, here it goes, Johnny told himself. What devilry was going to take place now?
Fortunately, that day he had gotten a fat young bull. He swiftly went about his work. He quartered it and rolled up 2 quarters in the hide, putting it outside the door. Chrissy, he called. Put me together enough smoked meat for a week. Also, think about what you'll need for that time.
You're leaving?
Was there a trace of panic in Chrissy's voice?
Just for a little while.
Both girls looked apprehensive. They seemed so forlorn in there. Johnny cursed to himself.
I'll be sure to come back, he said. Get busy with the food.
He inspected Blodgett's wound. Blodgett could walk now, but torn muscles had ended her running days. The grazing problem for the horses was a little rough. He did not want to turn them loose, but he couldn't stake them to a week's grazing all in one spot. He finally settled it by letting them loose, but instructing Patty to call them to the barrier a couple of times a day to talk to them. Patty promised she would. He prepared a belt pouch with flint and tinder, cutting glass, and a few odds and ends. He folded up a complete suit of buckskins. He made a pack of these and 2 kill clubs. When Turl came back later in the evening and opened the cage door, Johnny rapidly moved in what Chrissy would need. She could smoke beef and work with hides. It would keep them busy. He took the packet she had prepared.
You will be all right, Johnny, she asked.
He didn't feel like smiling, but he smiled. I'll make it my first business in all cases, he said. Now don't you worry. Put some of that tallow on Patty's neck and it will help the chafing.
Come on, said Turl, irritably, outside the cage.
How do you like the glass to cut things with? Said Johnny. Chrissy said,
It is very good if you don't cut yourself.
Well, be careful.
Hey, said Turl.
Johnny gave Patty a kiss on the cheek. Now you take good care of your sister, Patty. He put his arms around Chrissy and hugged her. Please don't worry.
For crap, come on out of that cage, said Turl.
Chrissy's hand trailed down Johnny's arm. He drew away until only their fingers were touching.
Be careful, Johnny.
Tears were rolling down her cheeks. Turl yanked him out and banged the cage door behind him. While Johnny closed the wood barrier, Turl turned on the juice.
At dawn, said Turl, I want you down at the landing field ready to go. Personnel freighter 91. Wear decent clothes and boots that won't stink the ship up. Bring your air pump and plenty of bottles and an extra mask. Is that understood, animal?
He rumbled off, practically trotting. Turl was a busy fellow these days. The ground shake died out. Later, Johnny picked some wildflowers and berries in the dark and tried to throw them between the bars, but the electric current simply arced and sizzled them before they could get through. It made things seem even worse. He went to bed at last, dispirited, certain that the future was going to be very rough, if not fatal. 7. They were aloft at last, flying just to the east of north, rising rapidly to an altitude of over 10 miles. Turl loomed over the control panel, silent and withdrawn. Johnny sat at the co-pilot console, the seatbelt wrapped around him twice, air mask tending to mist. It was growing very cold in the flight cab. They were late getting off because Turl had personally gone over every fitting and unit of the plane, as though suspicious that someone might have sabotaged it. The actual ship number was 18 digits long, and only ended in 91. It was an old ship, a cast-off from some war on some other planet, and it showed its scars in dents and sears. It had a forward flight compartment like any freighter, but it was armored and fitted with batteries of air-to-air and air-to-ground blast guns. The huge body of the plane, now empty, was fitted to carry not ore, but 50 company attack troops. There were huge benches, bins for supplies, racks for their blast guns. There were many ports, all armored. The plane had not carried troops or even been flown for ages. Seeing that breathe gas compression would be off in the compartment, Johnny had thought it might be better to ride there, but Turl put him in the co-pilot seat. Now he was glad. This altitude probably had little air in it, and the cold was seeping into the cab with icy fingers. Below them, the mountains and plains spread out, apparently not moving at any great speed, even though the plane was well above hypersonic. Soon, Johnny knew he was looking at the top of the world. Pale green misty sea and white vastnesses of ice were all across the northern horizon. They were not going to cross the North Pole, but nearly. The chattering console computer was rolling itself out a tape of their successive positions. Johnny looked at it. They were turning in a curve to head more easterly. "Where are we going?" said Johnny. Turl didn't answer for some time. Then he yanked an intergalactic mining chart of the planet from a seat pocket and threw it at Johnny.
"You're looking at the world, animal. It's round."
Johnny unfolded the chart. "I know it's round. Where are we going?"
"Well, we're not going up there,"
said Turl, pointing a talon toward the north.
"That's all water in spite of its looking solid. Just ice. Don't never land there. You'd freeze to death."
Johnny had a chart open. Turl had drawn a red curving course line from the area of departure, up across a continent, then across a large island, and then down to the top of another island. Typical of a mining map, it was all in numbers and without names. He translated rapidly in his head back to Chinko geography. Using ancient names, the course lay up over Canada, across the top of Greenland, past Iceland, and down to the north tip of Scotland. On the mine map, Scotland was 89-72-13. After punching in a new series of coordinates, Turl put the ship on automatic and reached back of his seat for a container of Kerbango. He slurped some into his container cover and chewed it down.
"Animal," said Turl above the roar of the ship, "I am about to recruit 50 man-things."
"I thought we were almost gone."
"No, rat brain. There are some groups in various inaccessible places on the planet."
"And," said Johnny, "having gotten them, we are going to take them back to the defense base." Turl looked at him and nodded.
"And you're going to help."
"If I'm going to help, maybe we better talk over how we are going to do this." Turl shrugged.
"Simple. There's a village up in the mountains, where you see that red circle. This is a battle plane. We just dive in with stun blasts and then walk around and load the ones we want aboard."
Johnny looked at him. "No."
Hostile, Turl said, "You promised."
"I know what I promised. I'm saying no because your plan won't work."
"These guns can be set to stun. They don't have to be put on a kill setting."
"Maybe you better tell me what these men are going to do," said Johnny.
"Why, you're going to train them on machines. I thought you could figure that out yourself, rat brain. You've been ferrying the machines. So what's wrong with this plan?"
"They won't cooperate," said Johnny. With a frown, Turl studied that.
Leverage, leverage.
It was true that he wouldn't have leverage.